Thank you for listening to Everything is Workable, the podcast where we examine how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I'm in conversation with other people about their approach to life and practice. Today's episode is with Erin Lane, a Jesus follower and feminist, as well as an author, editor, and the Assistant Program Director for Clergy and People of Faith Programs at the Center for Courage and Renewal. We discuss her book, Lessons in Belonging from a Church-Going Commitment Phobe, and the importance of contemplative practice, self-reflection, and intention. She also shares what it means to move at the speed of her soul, a concept and practice I've already added to my own toolkit. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and visit CaitlinSCHatch.com to leave a tip to help fund the production of the show. And now, on to my conversation with Erin. So, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Yeah, I'm excited.
And so I like to start out by asking my guests to share a little bit about their practice and their approach to life, which I know about a little bit because I read your entire book in a day.
Oh my.
Yeah. So what happened was with our previous interview that we had to reschedule, I actually didn't get your book until 4 days beforehand, and I wanted to be prepared for an interview. So I received Lessons in Belonging from a Church-Going Commitment Phobe, and then I sat down and read it in an entire day.
I hope that's because you enjoyed it and not because it felt like a task that you had to accomplish in light fire speed.
No, I enjoyed it immensely. It was, it's a really awesome book. And I think it outlines your practice very well. But if you could share for the listeners how you would describe your practice and approach to life.
That's a great question that I have not been asked to frame in that particular language. So as I thought about it, my approach to life, I think, can best be summed up in some song lyrics from singer-songwriter Carrie Newcomer, which is really my approach to life is to travel at the speed of soul.
Nice.
And for me, that means a practice of going to bed early and waking up late. I'm still an adult that sleeps 9 to 10 hours a night. I work 5 hours a day, 4 days a week, because I don't know how humans are wired to work full-time jobs, or at least what we in the West call full-time jobs. And on Saturdays, I take a Sabbath from scheming and shopping and shuttling children. And while this approach to life, I think, is definitely informed by my Christian commitment and embodied in my work as a retreat facilitator with the Center for Courage and Renewal, it really is done out of necessity because slow is just the way my soul is wired. And I literally have one speed, and it doesn't go much faster, and it doesn't go much slower. This is just the immutable presence of who I am at 33.
Okay, so you've used the word commitment here. And just to, I mean, there's so many things about your book that I'd love to riff on with you and just talk about, but I did notice, and I found this quite striking, that on page 182, right near the very end, is when you use the word introvert to describe yourself. And when I was reading the book, I was like 2 chapters into it maybe, and I remarked to my wife that I thought that a good alternative title could have been Lessons in Belonging from a Church-Going Introvert rather than Commitment Phobe, because I don't see any signs that commitment is a challenge for you, or that wasn't the impression that I got. You married at 22, albeit with some apprehension, which makes sense. I mean, I think you should be – I think it's healthy to be slightly apprehensive when you make that kind of commitment to anyone. but you also have a master's in theology – and you insisted on taking communion when you were 5. So I'm not Catholic. I don't have a Catholic background, but my wife does. And so she was like, that's young and that's that's gung-ho kind of thing.
Yes, it's earnest.
Very, very earnest. But I think those are all kind of self-commitment things. And that seems to be a really strong part of your practice is your Christian faith. So why commitment phobe and not introvert for the title?
So one, there's a book called Introverts in the Church that I read a couple of years ago and loved and was like, ma, someone already covered that. I've thought about many titles since the book came out 2 years ago, but one of them was Lessons in Belonging for People Who Don't Like People. Because sometimes I think my problem is I just don't enjoy people that much. Although I will say I like people once I'm with them for a good long while, but getting motivated to be with them for a good long while takes a lot, which I think is, you know, emblematic of introvertism. Mm-hmm. So that is certainly astute of you to have read that into the book long before I copped to it. I think, too, after having written the book, I came to the same conclusion that you did, that actually I'm not a commitment phobe. What I am is terrified to make commitments that aren't meaningful, that mm-hmm. I don't understand the reason behind them, that feel more rote than out of relationships. And so what I am is Spartan about making commitments, but the ones I make, I think I do pretty wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that is a word I would use to describe myself, despite it being immemorialized in my book title. But I think I care a lot about commitment and therefore give my yes very few times in a day, in a week, in a month, in a life.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's probably a really healthy approach, but it requires sort of a fine balance where you're not, and that comes across in the book, where you're not resistant to being involved out of fear, but out of, because you like, you genuinely want to have your heart in it.
Yeah. I had a friend once say to me, and I don't mean this as a criticism, but I feel like you're always a little disappointed in life. And I said, yes, because I can always see how something could be a little bit more intentional. I care so much about things being intentional and relationships being intentional and conversations being intentional. And you can probably tell I'm not a very spontaneous person because I like things to be so well thought out. And there's certainly much I have to learn from the kind of holy mischief that comes from being unintentional about certain things in your life. But I think I'm always longing for people to be a little bit more explicit about what is going on, why it is happening, and why it's meaningful. And if that isn't there, I get ornery or I step up to leadership and think this could be done better.
Are you familiar with koans?
No, tell me about this.
Okay, so a koan is comes from Zen Buddhism. And the best definition I ever heard for what a koan is comes from Pema Chodron. She says that it's a question that can't be answered with the conceptual mind. Mm. And so when you're describing this and you're talking about that, it's really like a life koan. And I saw your whole book as a presentation of a particular life koan that you have, which I think a lot of people have, which you present right at the beginning with the question. And you say, I want to belong, but I don't know how, which is such a koan, especially when you're talking about like community and relating to people. And it, like you said, sort of the discomfort that can come from relating to people. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about in the communities in which we practice, there's some importance for that, obviously, like, and that's where this koan comes into play, is these things don't happen in isolation. We are always in relationship with everyone around us. So in your book, you like you say, I like the idea of church, but feel disillusioned by the reality of the people who make it up. So what are the ways that you work with this koan in your life?
Well, writing clearly is one of them. If I can't figure something out with my rational mind alone, I try to get into the more imaginative, creative arts. And then, of course, right, I came up with 6 beautiful lessons of belonging that should explain everyone's woes, but don't by the end of the book. Certainly don't account for mine. And I was adamant that my publisher not use the past tense on the back of my book. They wanted to say something like, and now Erin had learned the lessons of belonging. And I was just like, no, no. Like, this is one snapshot of a life at a particular time in a particular place. And you know, here I am 2 or 3 years after, and I don't even think I'm a commitment phobe. So I think that just goes to show that questions keep working on us, and we come to different conclusions at different points in our life and have to hold each of those with some grace for ourselves and some lightness as we go about talking about them with others. But I do think it's a question that I will continue to struggle with because of my personality type. I am enamored with the Enneagram, as are many folks my age and in my profession of spiritual formation. And I'm an Enneagram 5, which means I hoard information.
Okay.
And I hoard time. So I'm a hoarder that really values simplicity. I don't have a lot of stuff in my house, and I have like far less clothes than my husband does, but I hoard ideas really, and often feel like until I have swallowed it all, I am not equipped to say something, to put something out there. So, you know, I think that, again, I have more to learn about the magic of being less rehearsed in life. But I do think that often how I've come at this question is to gather lots of information in books, data from other people, and then ruthless self-examination that I think all writers are adept at. And that is my practice.
What's the Enneagram?
Enneagram, yeah. Enneagram? It's like a Celtic personality profile where there are 9 different numbers that can be used to describe you. But the cool thing about it is the 9 different numbers are sort of points on a circle. You can look at this visually and see what numbers you move toward when you are healthy and what tendencies you move toward when you are unhealthy, and what it looks like to be married to another number or working in a collegial relationship with another number. So I like that you don't get fully boxed in by a profile type, but that there's a lot of movement between the different numbers based on your life circumstances and the people that you're in relationship with.
Oh, that's really interesting. That sounds very cool. It makes me, I've recently been doing a bit of study into the 5 Buddha families, which I don't feel like I'm actually at a point where I can speak to it with great confidence yet. But it sounds like a similar kind of thing where it's a very flexible structure for looking at how you relate to people around you and the energies that you bring to different environments, and how it shifts as well over time. I like the circular aspect of these things.
Me too. So I'm curious, if you wrote Lessons in Belonging, I don't know what your cone is, what one of those big meaty juicy questions is that directs your life. So maybe you might start there. But I'm also curious, what are some of the lessons you've learned about belonging in your life?
Well, it's interesting.
You are titling chapters.
It's interesting that you asked that, because I was thinking about Sangha while I was reading it. So Sangha is what we call community in Buddhism. And there's actually kind of 2 levels of Sangha. As a Buddhist, you take refuge in the Sangha. You're not taking refuge in the other people that you practice with. You're actually taking refuge in the Bodhisattvas and the Arhats. So basically like the semi-enlightened or nearly enlightened beings, because they're a good example to you of what you yourself can obtain. But then there is actually the Sangha that is the practice community, who are as neurotic and weird as you are. And for myself, I've never really felt any kind of challenge with belonging. But when it's come to connecting with a particular Sangha, a specific Sangha, and that Buddhism has lots of specific groups, I've struggled to find one that's a good fit. And probably kind of for similar reasons, that you struggle to find a church, or that you might be hesitant to join a church until you feel like you're really, really ready to commit, because it's that, I liked how you described it as dating. It's kind of stressful and weird, and it might be awkward sometimes, and you don't necessarily want to take that next step unless you can absolutely trust that, I guess, both you and the community are going to be able to do the work together in a valuable, meaningful way.
Yeah.
And actually, that leads me into another question, is in your acknowledgements, you thank your husband, Rush, at the very end. And I thought it was very beautiful how you describe him as a saint. Oh, your book's very funny as well, by the way. And this was one of the bits which it made me giggle. I thought it was very sweet and amusing. But what I love best about it is that you finish it with, "I choose you." So that made me so happy, because that is actually a phrase that my wife and I use with each other probably as often as "I love you" or "I appreciate you," which we say to each other multiple times a day. And I like how in your book you described that when you met Rush, you felt like running away from him would be running away from God, as your relationship was developing at the beginning. And I know that my relationship with my wife definitely brings me closer to the Dharma and makes me a much better practitioner. So could you talk a bit about how being in an intimate relationship feeds your practice?
That's a great question. I don't know where I heard this when I was growing up in the evangelical church, and I grew up Catholic, but then my mom started dabbling in non-denominationalism, so I ended up what I describe as charismatic Catholic. So I've got a deep love of liturgy, but I know a lot of the evangelical sayings and truisms and language. And one of the things I remember hearing growing up was that if you wanted to serve Christ, you should remain single, because you would have more energy and you would have more availability and be able to be more singularly focused. But if you wanted to know Christ, you should get married, because there was something about the crucible of intimate relationships that really revealed your own limits and shadows and the need for loving kindness and grace and vulnerability and all the things that one experiences in an intimate relationship. I feel like that is a false dichotomy, that you don't have to choose between serving God and knowing God. But I do think coming face to face with someone else in an intimate relationship is how I understand Moses seeing God in the Old Testament story of Exodus, and the people that were, you know, Jesus's earliest followers who got to journey with him. The face-to-face relationship brings out the ugly, but the ugly somehow kind of further amps up the glory, that it's kind of the best of times and the worst of times being in an intimate relationship. And you know, in Christian marriage ceremonies, at least more traditional ones, the bride walks down the aisle with a veil over her face to kind of signify that, you know, this face-to-face relationship is beginning today with you. Mm-hmm. And that until making such a major commitment, I have been veiled to myself and to other people. And there is something that I'm stripping away to be in this relationship with you. And so I think that that stripping away, that bearing your face amongst other things you will bear with an intimate partner, is just pretty humiliating in like the in just one of the most beautiful ways. It's humiliating to be in an intimate relationship, but actually being in an intimate relationship and seeing the grossness of your own humanity and in theirs as well, your partners, somehow it makes you a little more kinder to yourself and others, I think, if it's a healthy relationship, because you are more in touch with your own need for other people, your own need for a God or a larger presence or order of things to be caught up in, that it just becomes really obvious when you're living in such close proximity with someone else, both emotionally and physically, that you can't do that alone, that we can't do this life alone. So Rush has always been one of those people, Rush and my mom, who kind of have seen, not kind of, have fully seen my worst, my crazy, not that crazy is bad, but like the moments in which I have spewed things that I'm sure folks think I couldn't possibly spew, and still kind of said after it, "It's okay. Like, I still love you. I still choose you." So I know I'm not saying anything new that most people who are in intimate relationships don't already know, but really until I met Rush, intimate relationships were a hindrance to my relationship with God. they actually felt like they were putting more of a veil up between me and God because I was making compromises I didn't want to make, or because I was only showing part of who I was in order to please or adapt to someone else's style. And so I think that's another way of putting it. It wasn't until meeting Rush that I realized moving closer to him was moving closer to myself and therefore moving closer to God. Whereas every other relationship, when I moved away from the relationship, I felt like I became more myself and I knew myself better and clearer. So that was one way in which I discerned that that was a pretty fantastic relationship to hold on to, although not always a pleasurable one.
Yeah. There definitely is an assumption that goes around about relationships, like some aspect of it's being blissful and easy or something like that. But then there's also the assumption sometimes that relationships are really challenging and difficult only. And whenever I talk to people about my past relationships and where I am now in this place of genuinely choosing someone and saying how, like, it's really about finding that balance. And when you find someone where you find that balance, where you truly feel seen and you truly are open and willing to see them, it's completely different from any perception that we might carry about what we think relationships should be like. When we see, like, oh, we are in relationship and there are certain people that we're going to be compatible with to be in relationship in a way where they can see us warts and all and still accept us for who we are, and we can feel how good that feels and give that back. And for me, I see it as, like, I want to be able to do that for a wider and wider group of people. And so I practice it really well in the intimate relationship I have so I can bring it out into the world.
I love that. I think that you use the word balance, sort of a balance of, I don't know if you'd put it in these terms, pain and pleasure, or, you know, glory and humiliation. I feel like that's a tension, that's a creative tension that not enough people talk about, that's really important to discerning whether a relationship is the one, or a good one to hang on to. And I think it's part of what I was trying to wrestle with in Lessons in Belonging with finding a church. And at some point I come to this wordplay that, you know, writers always love when we find something that's like a little nugget that just has beautiful alliteration and sticks with you, whether it sticks with anyone else, who knows. But you mentioned earlier that I talk about how disillusionment with the church is a good thing. Because it's stripping away that veil, it's stripping away all of the illusions that keep us from being fully ourselves in community. And ideally, I think that's what the church and communities should be for us, as places where we can be fully ourselves and test out who that self is. But I do think there's a big difference between a church that is disillusioning and one that is delusional. And I think it's the same thing for relationships, that there are some relationships that are painful, but are good relationships. And they're painful for the right reasons. They're painful because you're confronted with your own shadows. They're painful because you realize how broken everybody is. You know, they're painful for a lot of different reasons that aren't bad reasons and aren't reasons to run from. And then there are relationships that are painful for very toxic reasons, because you are being dehumanized by the way they talk to you, because your imagination is shrinking because of the possibilities you see in the pulpit or in your life. And for me, those are spinning the illusions that healthy relationship and healthy community is supposed to be stripping us of. So, and again, just because of that fun wordplay between disillusioning and delusional doesn't mean we automatically know whether a community or a relationship fits neatly into one of those categories. But I do think it's a tension we need to talk more about and flesh out with others in community. Because too often there are people that run at the first sight of pain, or there are people that think pain has something to teach them and stay much longer in relationships than they should.
Yeah. Wow. I know that one.
So how did you know your wife was the one? Like, what was, like, if someone asked you that question and they were trying to discern, you know, a good relationship, like, how did you discern that for you?
A lot of things.
we actually, this is an interesting practice that we both did very early on in our relationship because it moved at a pace that I think a lot of people might find alarming. But for both of us, because we had been in previous relationships where we knew exactly what a healthy relationship definitely didn't look like, when we were confronted with it, it was so obvious, which would be one of the reasons that I knew. And I would definitely say there was like a deep bone knowing. We actually composed emails back and forth to each other that we called Reasons Why, which was why we wanted to make a commitment of marriage to each other, specifically choosing marriage just because it is the most recognizable way of validating a relationship in our society. And because we're both from different countries, so it makes life a little bit easier for immigration purposes and all that. But on a much deeper level, it was really going beneath the surface of just the things that you like in common into something a lot more profound and a lot more fundamental, and having the same fundamental approach to life, to practice, that we have the same sort of commitment to the Dharma and to waking up, basically, which was a very key thing for both of us, because both of us at the time that we met each other had basically decided that we shouldn't be in relationship because we couldn't have the level of practice that we wanted. If you were with someone. So I just think that's like the universe's beautiful way of going, oh, really? You think you know how you have to practice? Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. So another question that I feel is like a very key one I definitely don't want to miss out on with you is, you don't shy away from calling yourself a feminist. And I'm fist bumping you for that, which is great.
Awesome.
And there's two questions really that I have around that. One is, how do you define feminism? Because I believe that it is one of those words that needs to be defined because it gets very nebulous. And then two is, in what ways do you bring feminism into your practice?
I'm sure I have a definition I've written somewhere of feminism, but you're making me do this on the spot.
Sorry.
I think feminism has something to do with men and women and everyone. I used to say everyone in between, but I don't think it's a pole. So all genders being created in the image of a genderful God and working on behalf of genders who have been marginalized to bring them into the full image, a full potential of who they can be fully alive as humans. I also think on the flip side of that, that means relinquishing the power of privilege that some genders have been afforded. And for me, that's, you know, best modeled and imitated in Jesus's life, what it looks like to sort of lay down certain things that you could call equality on and say, no, it's not necessarily about equality. It's about everyone becoming fully human.
Wow, that's solid.
And then the second question, I might change my mind later about that definition, but that's what I got today. The second question, you know, feminism in my practice, there's so many things I would call feminist about my life and practice. I think what I talked about at the beginning, moving at the speed of my soul, certainly comes out of my Christian commitment, as I said, and my work that I do as a retreat facilitator, where we're always about helping people slow down and listen more deeply to the inner life that's welling up in them. For me, that is the most feminist thing I do, is move slowly, because I just think the speed at which most of us are being formed to move at is incredibly mechanical and incredibly patriarchal and incredibly oppressive to us being fully human.
Preach.
And so when I graduated from college as an anthropology major, which I always joke is like what liberal arts majors major in when they don't want to pick something, I had no idea what I was going to do with this degree, because I had all of these ideas of the things that could be feminist career paths, but didn't know which one sort of felt like the one I wanted to throw my weight behind. And for me, on a policy level, what became clear to me after college was that it had to do with a more sustainable work life, that work should feel more fully human than it does for a lot of people. And that meant policy changes like parental leave and better sick policies and more vacation time and more people of diversity in positions of leadership who have a different sense of time and deadlines and when things need to be done. People that were more environmentally conscious that realized when you ask people to travel for work, you know, you are asking them to do damage to the environment. I mean, all sorts of things all sort of coalesced into what at the time I was calling work-life balance, but now I just think is about finding wholeness in your work and whether that's paid or not. But how do you sort of bring your best creative capacities to life in a day? And what are the policies that support that? And what are the actual practices? So for me, my practices are all about how am I going to be as fully human today as I can be? And that has meant doing embarrassingly less than everyone else. I should pause here to say, if you don't hear it in my voice, there is a certain self-righteousness to being this slow. And I do think there are moments where I am probably called to be quick about the right things and to be quick about the right relationships and to be quick about the right political action needed. And so again, that is one of my growing edges, but being slow is something I both really value and appear to be quite good at. So that is my primary feminist practice.
It's kind of like that slow and easy wins the race, taking a different approach. How do you discern the difference between laziness and slowness that is actually focused slowness that allows you to do one thing very well to the best of your ability without the rushing versus just sort of procrastination?
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing is I check in with other people sort of be like, am I being ridiculous? And so my husband will always joke, like, you work more than anyone I know. And I'm like, that's crazy. And he's like, it's just that your work is to be a contemplative. And so it just looks really different. So sometimes hearing people say that, I'm like, okay, I'm not at risk of being a sloth. But I think often I check in with myself. Yeah, that's probably accurate. I check in with my many different threads of self when I'm having moments or seasons that do feel really slow and kind of say, like, am I hiding from something? Am I watching a third episode of House Hunters Renovation because that's actually what my soul needs? Or because I'm avoiding something, that there's some dread, that there's some fear of taking the risk and of doing the work. And so it's really checking in pretty regularly to say, do I actually feel alive or am I hibernating? And I think seasons of hibernating are great and are the way the world is set up with the seasons and are the way that our bodies are set up. But, you know, if I get to April and I'm still in like Christmas mode, then there's some self-examination that I have to do with, like, hey, things are blooming outside. Where are you blooming in your life? So I feel really grateful that nature has those regular rhythms built in so I can sort of take my cue too from the natural world about when it's time to get moving and producing and scattering some seed and when it's okay to be really, really slow about life for, you know, months on end.
I like it because I think that both the tactic of avoidance and the tactic of over busyness, because I have the opposite problem. I tend to do far too much and still get down on myself for not getting enough things done. And I come to appreciate how both of those approaches, whether it's that hibernating at the wrong time or it's overexerting yourself, are still the same, like they come from the same place of kind of avoiding living life and really being present for it.
Mm.
So the seasons are very good for taking your cues from.
Yes. And like daylight hours, you know, like when it's dark, It's okay if you like fall asleep on the couch with a glass of wine at 8. Like you weren't really gonna do anything productive after 8:30.
Yeah.
Or I wasn't, right? Like so yeah, there are lots of I think good external reminders too if we are feeling cut off from the internal ones.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, definitely. So you wrote one of my favorite quotes from your book, which was one of the bits that I found funny, is that you said, I'm going to have to stop telling people that I'm just writing a book about being awkward. But I think that that's also a really lovely, honest, and helpful thing to set out as like the framework of it, because I think a lot of people feel really awkward all the time. And don't appreciate that everyone kind of feels awkward. So what's your practice around working with your own awkwardness? Or rather, because really what the impression I get is accepting your own awkwardness.
Yeah, well, at my 30th birthday, so I finished this book when I was 29, finished the writing part of it, and had a 30th birthday party where I had all of my girlfriends write down a word about themselves that they were done with. Like they just wanted to lay that word about themselves to rest. And we did the stereotypical girls' night bonfire where you take that word and you burned it. And I wrote down the word awkward. Like I was like, I'm so tired of referring to myself as awkward because I don't know that I actually am any more awkward than other people. I'm just a little bit aggressively honest about my awkwardness. And I feel awkward if other people aren't being aggressively honest about theirs. So like that's awkward. But I don't think, yeah, that I'm, again, particularly more awkward than the average bear. And so one practice was trying to, you know, use it less in my vocabulary. And I think mm-hmm. that also is a feminist impulse because I don't need to be so self-deprecating. I don't need to be relatable. I think there's a cult of relatability with women that we, you know, we try to slay up the things about ourselves that might be quirky or endearing and not altogether powerful. And I think I go into conversations now just knowing that I am an intense, self-righteous, dark person who is doing their best just like everyone else is. And I don't need to apologize for it verbally unless I have done something, you know, with ill intent or that I hear later had negative effects. And I come home and I, like many people, replay the many awkward conversations I had during the day. And I have to let those go. And I have to just sort of, I mean, it's my practice to hear a thought and go, oh, you know what? I hear you. And that's not the time for that right now. If you are still around tomorrow at the same exact time, I will deal with you. But if you are insignificant, like most of the conversations I replay at the end of my day, you will be gone by tomorrow at this time because there will be new conversations I'm obsessed with. So I think letting go, too, of all of the ways in which I could analyze and overanalyze how I am showing up in the world is part of my practice, is letting go, acknowledging that those are very real things that most of us deal with, and also saying, I don't have time for you. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I need to be powerful. And that doesn't mean I'm not awkward, but I'm also powerful, and that's where I'm going to put my energy.
Well, that's awesome. So what are some supports or guidance or resources that you'd like to offer to listeners?
Well, I've mentioned a couple of times the Center for Courage and Renewal, which mm-hmm. is the primary organization I work with. It's based out of Seattle, Washington, and it was an organization that was started for teachers to help them with burnout. A lot of great people were going into the profession and then realizing as they came up against bureaucracy, brokenness, all sorts of things that were dehumanizing that they were tempted to walk away and choose something else. Mm-hmm. So our organization helps people now, not just teachers, but folks in the serving professions and beyond, take heart in their work. And I think there are lots of ways to engage with the center's work that I have found incredibly transformative in my own life as a participant and then later as a facilitator. But one of the things that we do and on our retreats is we try to listen to the voice of the inner teacher. Mm-hmm. And that is a Quaker phrase that just refers to the voice of integrity, the Holy Spirit. There are all sorts of names for it, but that you slow down long enough to hear what the speed of your soul actually is. And so, one, I would recommend, if you got nothing else out of this interview, ask yourself that question. What is the pace at which I'm longing to live life? And can I start making some small decisions, some small no's, some small yeses that will help me move into closer alignment with my inner life and my outer realities? So the question, I think, is the first resource I'd offer. And then if you're more curious about how to operationalize some of these practices in community, so it's one thing that I've talked about a lot of my personal practices, but what does that look like in a church? What does that look like at a yoga studio? What does that look like in a classroom? Then I would really recommend our co-founder, Parker Palmer's books. He's got a lot of amazing ones, but my favorite is Let Your Life Speak. It's a really small little peachy book that looks like a book you'd give someone at their college graduation. But I have come back to it every year, and there are lines from that that have helped me kind of come back and calibrate my life to a way that feels like it has more authenticity. So the question, what's the speed of my soul? The book, Let Your Life Speak. And then if you're curious about the Center for Courage and Renewal, it's www.couragerenewal.org. And you can just learn more about what we do and see if there's any experiences that are close to your home that you could see what it means like to slow down in community with other people.
That's brilliant. I also recommend highly the interview with Parker Palmer and, I've just blanked on her name.
Courtney Martin
on being, which is how I actually, in a very roundabout way, happened to find you, which is awesome. So there you go. So you listen to On Being, find amazing people. It works out really well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you for your thoughtfulness. Aww. From one intentional person to another. I really appreciated it.
Thank you for listening. Visit erinslane.com to find out more about Erin's writing and work, and visit couragerenewal.org to learn more about the support and services that they offer. To find out more about what I do, visit kaylinschatch.com, where you can sign up to get my monthly wrap-up email, read my blog, check out my artwork, and leave a tip to help support my work in the world. Thank you as well to Dexter Britton for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous two seasons of Everything is Workable.